week, President Biden gave his State of the Union address. And today, in New Idea Live, the podcast of the Ayn Rand Institute, I will be interviewing my colleague Ben Bayer, and we will focus in one aspect of Biden's speech, and this is his domestic policy. And I expect this to be a revealing episode, as Biden's economic policy indicate a lot about how he views the world. So Ben, first of all, let us ask a more general question. Why shall we even care about this address? It has more of a ceremonial character these days, and if we believe the viewership data, way fewer people watch it these days than compared to the past.
Well, it's if you say it's just ceremonial to suggest it's superficial, I would say it's worse than that. It's become positively annoying because it's turned into a partisan political rally, basically a kind of stump speech by the incumbent who's currently running for election, and not very substantive as a result. It's obviously based on a constitutional requirement. The president's required to submit a report of the State of the Union every year to Congress. It could just as easily be a written report. It used to be. At the same time, as annoying as that political ceremony has now become, it does give us a window into the values of the leadership. They express a long wish list of various actions, legislation they'd like to enact, much of it which has no chance of being enacted given the fact that there's a divided government. But because it tells us what they'd at least like to do if they could, it gives us a window into what they would do if they had the power that they wanted. And especially since we're currently living in a divided government in the United States where there's a Democratic president, but a House that's dominated, that's controlled by the Republicans, the president doesn't get to do much of what he wants. It hasn't been able to for the last couple of years. So one result is at ARI, we haven't had much chance to comment on what he's done because he hasn't gotten anything done. Here's our chance to do it when he tells us what he would do if he could.
So let us begin by watching a clip that is important because it sets the tone for the narrative that the president chose for the occasion. Clip number one, please.
I was proud to be the first president to stand on the picket line. And today, Dawn has a good job in her hometown, providing stability for her family and pride and dignity as well. Showing once again, Wall Street didn't build America. They're not bad guys. They didn't build it, though. The middle class built the country, and unions built the middle class.
All right. So apparently there's a choice to be made here, Ben. On the one hand, Wall Street. On the other hand, the middle classes and the unions. And Biden made it clear which side he's on.
Well, he's not only telling us which side he's on, he's also revealing something about his view of the source of economic value by saying that not just labor, but labor unions are responsible for building everything of value in a modern industrial civilization. Now, this is a common trope that you hear from politicians. Noteworthy here is that you see in the background, I don't know if people caught this, you see Mike Johnson, who's of course the Republican Speaker of the House, quietly nodding in affirmation to what Biden says. And this is something he does very rarely throughout the speech. He's usually grimacing or rolling his eyes. On this one, he's not. He's actually subtly affirming what Biden has just said. So it's a trope you hear on both the left and the right that labor unions and labor is what built America. The other thing to say about it, though, is that this is a Marxist trope. So you might not be surprised that Biden is willing to affirm a Marxist trope. Maybe you should be a little more surprised that even Mike Johnson is doing it. Why is this a Marxist trope? Well, it's the idea that it's the sweat of the brow, physical labor, that creates economic value. That's the traditional labor theory of economics, that the labor theory of value that was affirmed by Karl Marx. And it's a false theory. It's false that the sweat of the brow is where economic value comes from. It's true, of course, that there's that nothing gets created in this world without somebody's physical labor, but it's necessary and not sufficient for the creation of value. You can't do anything of value with your muscles unless you know what you're doing, unless somebody knows how to build the product that needs to be built. So obviously that requires some kind of knowledge on the part of the laborer. But more importantly, if you look at the overall production process, it requires knowledge of people who made that laborer's job possible. That laborer might not have been able to put together the manufacturing line, or might not have known how to bring the product to market. This is something that required the scientific knowledge of the inventors, of the developers of the product, and even more importantly in certain ways, the business knowledge that it took to figure out how to finance the building of the assembly line, finance the development process of the product, to find a market for the product. So this Marxist theory that both the Democrats and the Republicans pay lip service to is false. It's not labor, it's the mind that is the fundamental source of economic value. And what that means is that it's just not true that Wall Street has only some kind of derivative role in the building of an industrial civilization. Finance is a form of knowledge work. It's about identifying the projects in this country that are worth building, the companies that are worth investing because they think there's a product that people will pay for that will deliver a profit, not only to the investors, but also, by the way, to the laborers. Without investment knowledge, no employment is created. There's not even any labor to speak of without that. And so this constant antipathy that Biden has for the role of the mind in production is, it's not just in this opening note, but you'll see it showing up indirectly in a lot of the other clips that we comment on. So remember this as we look through a number of his other proposals.
So one big villain is Wall Street. What is the other villain that is fashionable to attack these days? Of course, Big Pharma. So let's proceed to clip number two, please.
Americans pay more for prescription drugs than anywhere in the world. It's wrong, and I'm ending it. We finally beat Big Pharma. Instead of paying $400 a month or thereabouts for insulin with diabetes, and it only costs 10 bucks to make, they only get paid 35 a month now and still make a healthy profit. This year, Medicare is negotiating lower prices for some of the costliest drugs on the market that treat everything from heart disease to arthritis. It's now time to go further and give Medicare the power to negotiate lower prices for 500 different drugs over the next decade. Starting next year, the same law caps total prescription drug costs for seniors on Medicare at $2,000 a year. Even for expensive cancer drugs, it costs $10,000, $12,000, $15,000. I want to cap prescription drug costs at $2,000 a year for everyone.
So, Ben, what is happening here is that Biden is promising us a win-win deal. He says, look, drugs are expensive, so what I will do is I will make sure that drugs are cheaper, but at the same time, the pharmaceutical companies will continue to make a profit. So is it as good as he makes it sound?
Well, I mean, I'll just say what I was going to say, which is that this is what I was asking people to look for, this kind of contempt for the mind as the source of economic values. And this is particularly pronounced when you're talking about a knowledge-intensive industry like the pharmaceutical companies. And I mean, it's true what he says, that Americans pay higher prices on average for prescription drugs in this country compared to other industrialized countries. I should mention, from what I've read, we actually pay lower prices for generic drugs. It's the patented drugs that offset that drive the average up. But there are reasons worth considering for why these patented drugs are so high in cost. It's true, as he avers, that once you've got a successful drug, successful both scientifically speaking and financially speaking, that the cost of production is low per unit. It's got a low, what the economists call a low marginal cost of production. Once you've set up the once you've got a workable formula and once you've got your manufacturing processes in place, it's very cheap to produce each extra pill. But that's only after there's been a very high overhead average cost for research plowed into this drug. And that's especially because of the fact that there are all kinds of drugs that pharmaceutical companies investigate, test, that for one reason or another don't end up making it to market. They have to explore all kinds of dead ends before they find one that actually works. It's a scientific process. And that's not even considering the fact that they then also have to go over the hurdle that's arbitrarily imposed by the FDA, not simply because of the fact that the FDA is a government entity that, at least in my opinion, shouldn't even exist. I think that drug quality is something that should be handled by the market, and there could easily be market mechanisms that would check this. But if you compare the FDA to other governmental drug approval agencies, like the ones they have in Europe, for instance, our FDA is much stricter than the ones in Europe. And you know, drugs can conceivably come to market faster here. The pharmaceutical companies wouldn't need to face such very expensive regulatory burdens in this country. So a lot of the cost here is on government. And that's not the only reason. One that's especially worth considering is that most of the rest of the world has overtly socialized medicine. Now, the system of medicine we have in this country is hardly free market. There's 1,000 ways in which the government is involved regulating it and subsidizing it. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But in the rest of the world, government basically owns healthcare in most every other industrialized country. And as a result of that, American pharmaceutical companies, when they try to sell their drugs to foreign countries, to customers in foreign countries, they have to go through governments to get them to these people. They have to negotiate with governments in just the way that Biden now wants to do with this country. And as a result, they're forced to sell these drugs at a much lower price than they would ordinarily sell them for, at an artificially lower price compared to what the market would give you. And so if these drug companies want to make a profit, that means they have to make up the difference somewhere. And so as a result, they charge American customers a higher price than they probably would if they weren't having to subsidize the rest of the world. When you consider the fact that a huge percentage of pharmaceutical innovation in the world comes from American companies, it raises the question, what happens when the profit margins dry up in the US? What happens when, in effect, Atlas shrugs for the rest of the world and we're not able to subsidize the rest of the world anymore? What will happen to healthcare in the rest of the world? Biden seems to think that drugs are something we just pick off the tree through brute force, again, that labor theory of value coming into play, and shows really no appreciation or gratitude here for the intellectual and the financial knowledge and work that has to go into creating something like a complex pharmaceutical product. That's that, and all of that means it is particularly galling that he should want to now try to force the minds of the scientists and the financiers to negotiate for these prices to meet the demands of the state medical cartel after they've already had to go over so many other burdens, after they've already had to deal with so many other costs in an industry that requires free use of the mind. It's really abominable.
But apparently, corporate greed is not only to be met in pharmaceutical companies in the Wall Street, but also in the companies that bring us our chocolate bars, which apparently are becoming shorter. Let's proceed to the next clip, please.
Too many corporations raise prices to pad their profits, charging more and more for less and less. That's why we're cracking down on corporations that engage in price gouging and deceptive pricing, from food to healthcare to housing. In fact, the snack companies think you won't notice if they change the size of the bag and put a hell of a lot fewer, same size bag, put fewer chips in it. No, I'm not joking. It's called shrinkflation. Pass Bobby Casey's bill and stop this. I really mean it. The You probably all saw that commercial on Snickers bars. You get charged the same amount, and you got about, I don't know, 10% fewer Snickers in it. Look, I'm also getting rid of junk fees. Those hidden fees at the end of your bill that are there without your knowledge. My administration announced we're cutting credit card late fees from $32 to $8. Banks and credit card companies are allowed to charge what it costs them to instigate the collection. And that's more, a hell of a lot, like $8 and 30-some dollars. They don't like it. Credit card companies don't like it. But I'm saving American families $20 billion a year with all the junk fees I'm eliminating. Folks at home, that's why the banks are so mad, is $20 billion in profit. I'm not stopping there. My administration has proposed rules to make cable, travel, utilities, and online ticket sellers tell you the total price up front so there are no surprises. It matters.
Okay, Ben, too much to unpack here. So crisps packs getting fewer crisps in the pack, transaction fees. So what is happening here?
Well, one thing to notice, it is a bit confusing what's happening here because he's throwing together a whole lot of very different issues and treating them like they're all the same. On the one hand, you have complaints about rising costs in food, healthcare, housing, versus the shrinking snacks, which is a really funny example. I'm really sorry to hear about President Biden's Snicker habit, but it doesn't really affect people too much. All of them are being grouped together as price gouging here, which is a basically meaningless term, talking about higher prices that somebody doesn't like, that somebody wants to forbid. But we should break these down.
So let's start from the first one. Okay, so shrinkflation. First of all, what is shrinkflation? Is it a problem and should something be done about it?
Well, I'm not sure if the term shrinkflation is worth validating as a valid concept, but what he's getting at is the fact that, yeah, sometimes instead of raising the price of a product, producers will simply keep the price the same, but reduce the size because the raw materials takes to produce them are costing them more, and they don't want to pass along that higher price. Now, one thing to notice is that this is something that happens very rarely. If it didn't, we wouldn't be noticing rising prices across the board. It happens, from what I've read, mostly with a small segment of the market with paper products and with junk food. Incidentally, these are the same kinds of products the government usually wants to shame you for using too much of anyway, and often wants to tax you so that you will use less of them. So you have to question the sincerity here of government officials who sometimes say they want you to use less of them and then are suddenly worried that you actually are using less of them because of this market mechanism. Why is it that it only happens in this segment of the market and not in others? I would guess, I'm not an economist, but I would guess that it's because, well, these are cases where people probably know they should be using less of them anyway, so they're not bothered by the fact that they're getting less. And that's different from the other kinds of products. But what complaining about this phenomenon has the effect of doing is it's an attempt to distract the public from the underlying cause of the rising prices for producers, the reason that they're having to either raise the price or shrink the amount that they provide. And that's the statist economics. And the statist economics that is in which government assumes power over the economy, including flooding the economy with free cash. And during COVID, this happened at unprecedented rates. Between the Fed policy of historically low interest rates and programs like the PPP, where companies were just given free money, where individuals were mailed checks for not working. And so it's not a big surprise that you're going to have inflation. And at the end of the episode, by the way, I'll share a link to an interview that I did with an economist on this subject on the various government policies that led to the unprecedented rates of inflation. which I should mention are policies that were shared not only by the current administration, but by the previous administration. And nobody wants to talk about that. Nobody wants to say that these policies are what are basically responsible for the rising costs that we're facing now. And so let's find a way basically to blame the companies. And the legislation that the president announced just now, the camera went on Bob Casey, and there's this bill that he wants to pass that would in some way try to outlaw so-called shrinkflation by authorizing the FTC to label it as unfair or deceptive. And you have to think about what would it even mean to try to enforce something like that? Are you going to say it's illegal for a company to change the size of the product that it wants to sell to you, and that you don't have the right to buy it at whatever size it offers to sell? And how is it in any way deceptive, especially when everybody knows that it happens? Anyone's able to look at the label that says the amount of ounces or kilograms in a product, and you don't have to buy the smaller Snickers bar. Sometimes they offer larger ones too, if you really want. So it's really just a galling interference with the free market pricing system. And it's worth noting, of course, that if they stop doing this, the only alternative is to raise prices, to sell the same amount they were selling before. They would have to raise prices because, of course, the prices of their inputs are going up because of this overall rise in prices. And the interesting, if you look at the Casey bill, what he also anticipates this and says, well, if that happens, it will be greedflation. That's his neologism for this, as if companies are suddenly getting more greedy than they're getting greedier than they were before whenever a price goes up. So it's a real damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of dilemma that's being offered to producers here. And underlying the assumption of all of it is that there's something wrong with earning a profit, that they shouldn't be able to actually make more money, that they should be left, you know, to do with less. And it's also assuming that Snicker bars just grow on trees, which I'm sure is very disappointing to President Biden. But in fact, it requires planning, it requires thought, and it requires being able to earn the fruits of your labors for Snicker bars actually to get produced. And that has to be paid for somehow by somebody.
But okay, let's say the demand for Snickers is, as the economists say, elastic. I can live without Snickers. But what about rising costs in areas such as healthcare? Or we could also talk about housing, where people, it's not that it's literally an issue of life and death. So is Biden then in a legitimate position to say, look, maybe you laugh about the Snickers thing, but when it comes to rising costs in healthcare and housing, this is where I definitely need to do something.
Yeah, I mean, I think with these other markets, the reason you do see rising prices is, I mean, you can't give away less of it. You can't sell less of it and people will still be satisfied. They need as much as they can get. And so you see the prices very pronounced raising in healthcare, food, and housing. But here again, it's worth pointing to the reasons that everybody should know are responsible for this. I don't think you have to be a sophisticated economist to know this. I mean, in healthcare, we already talked about the cause of rising prices for pharmaceuticals. In other sectors of the healthcare industry, when you're talking about hospitals and doctors, et cetera, yes, it's obvious there's massive healthcare inflation, has been for decades. It's been happening since the 60s and 70s. And that's because the government passed forms of socialized medicine in the United States. We don't have the same kind that we have, that you have in Europe or in Canada, but you have Medicare and Medicaid, which subsidize healthcare costs for seniors and for the poor. You have EMTALA, which is a bill passed in the 1980s and signed by President Reagan, which forced hospitals to accept patients basically for free if they came into an emergency room. And somebody has to pay for that. What you get in because of all of these policies is you get an artificial increase in demand, either through subsidy or through mandate. People who are consuming healthcare who wouldn't otherwise pay for it at the market price. And that's buoyed by the fact that you also have tax incentives where employers are basically charged, are given a tax incentive to buy insurance for their employers are given this tax incentive to buy insurance for their employees, which means then that you have a third party that's paying for insurance. There's no incentive on the part of the consumers to actually keep prices down. So you have this artificial increase in demand buoyed by, in conjunction with, an artificial constriction on supply. There have been all kinds of ways in which government's done that over the course of decades. The most recent of them has been Obamacare. It's lowered reimbursement to providers in lots of ways, making a lot of them want to quit. Right now, we have a huge doctor shortage. It also, paradoxically, gave less money to emergency rooms because they had this theory that people were getting their health care through emergency rooms. So if you started giving them health insurance, they would stop going to the ER, start using doctors elsewhere. They therefore gave less money to ERs. That's part of the reason we saw the crises during COVID that we did, with ERs not being able to handle the influx of patients. And so what happens when you have artificially increased demand coupled with artificial restrictions on supply? You obviously are going to have, it's economics 101, that prices will go up. And so again, here we have complaints about rising prices directed against the actual producers, directed against the doctors, directed against the insurance companies, when in fact, it's government that's fundamentally responsible for this. In healthcare, it's even much greater rate of inflation than what you have generally. And that's because of the intensive amount of government intrusion in the healthcare market.
And what about housing, Ben? This is also a big issue. Many people in the younger generations, they believe that they've been robbed of the opportunity to buy a house because housing prices are so high. So can the president do something interventionist? Is there any way to bring the prices down? And to begin with, why are prices so high?
I mean, it's much the same story to tell here, especially with housing. You can again blame the Federal Reserve, which is a government entity. It's not a private this organization of bankers. It's a government entity that's basically setting the price of money. It's had historically low interest rates over the past few years, leading into and then intensifying during the COVID pandemic. This has obviously led to a huge expansion in demand for housing, driving up the prices everywhere. And that's on top of the fact that the places where people want to live are in cities where they won't let you build, where there's all kinds of local housing restrictions that stop people from building high rises, that stop people from putting more than a few houses on a given plot of land. You can only build single family housing. There's a lot of good work being done right now by the YIMBY movement saying, no, we should take down these local housing regulations. But they're not catching up fast enough with the rapid expansion in credit that we're still dealing with from the last few years. Biden's only solution here is, and we didn't play this part of the speech, is let's use antitrust law against landlords for charging rent that is too high, which is laughable because if there's a monopoly that they have on housing, it's only because, and they don't, but if you thought that they did, it would only be because, well, it's so hard for anyone to build new housing in these cities that, well, the last people left standing are in control of what's there. But even that's dramatic oversimplification and false and unjust on many levels. I mean, it's as if landlords have no losses to make up for after COVID. Does anybody remember how there were rent moratoria in many states where they weren't allowed to even charge rent after people stopped paying during the pandemic? And the same thing's true about healthcare. If prices are going up now, I mean, they've been going up over decades, but if there's suddenly more price rises happening, does anybody remember how there were lockdowns that stopped patients from seeing doctors? I mean, this caused massive losses in the healthcare industry, which is paradoxical because you'd think, oh, there's a pandemic happening and hospitals are being you know, crammed with patients. Well, only COVID patients, only COVID patients. You know, in many cases, they're not even able to charge for these. They make their money through other services. They're not allowed to provide these other services. Is it any wonder that they have losses that they're trying to make up right now? So no appreciation here for that fact. But more broadly, no appreciation for the fact that, again, all of the services that we're talking about are ones that require not just effort, not just the sweat of the brow, but the work of the mind to be able to plan for the future, work that they are not allowed to do or that is made more difficult, if not impossible, by the kind of restrictions we're now talking about. Doctors are not born with medical knowledge, knowing how to take care of people. Housing stock doesn't maintain itself without any kind of thought. And it's all being proposed here, again, as though none of the providers of services here, doctors or landlords, have any right to the pursuit of their happiness, as though they don't have the right, therefore, to make the most they can on a free market, especially when they've been encumbered with so many obstacles over the last few years. Suddenly they get the chance to make up a little bit of what they lost, and they're batted down again by people like Biden.
And one last point that I want to address. What about the issue of the so-called junk fee? So I make a bank transaction to you and I send you, let's say, $100. And then at the end, my bank says, oops, also you need to give me a particular amount. Biden presents junk fees as if they are something like a scam, as if this is a cost that is more than what you bargain. Has he got a claim here?
I mean, I think this is something very similar to the so-called shrinkflation phenomenon. You're only stating part of the price up front, and that's in a way there to distract from the fact that the price is higher. But, well, why is the price higher? I mean, we've talked about that already, but there's more to it than that. In this case, I think part of the reason this phenomenon gets started is because of things like sales taxes. So government puts a sales tax on every single consumer product you could buy. And if you're a producer and you're forced to pay this tax, why would you want to include it in the price? Why should you include it in the price? You're not the one who's benefiting from that. So, I mean, it makes sense to me, at least, that producers would want to say, here's our price and here's what the tax is, and separate those so that the consumer knows how much they're actually giving to the producer and how much is going to the government. Well, once that happens, it's then very easy for producers to start to add extra fees where they would otherwise show the tax. And you can, you know, debate about how nice of that it is for them to do. But sometimes it's actually useful because there are extra fees that you could opt out of. Like if you're talking about the fees for baggage when you're flying on an airline, I mean, you could actually cancel that fee if you don't bring a bag. It's not always like that. But what's important is that everybody knows that this is done. It's annoying, but you know that when you search for an airline ticket on a website that you're quoted a price and there's going to be a bunch of fees after that. And if you really are surprised by the new price, you can go back and you can search for another one and see what the other price is going to be. So at worst, it's annoying, but it's not any kind of deception on the part of the producer. It's not coercive. And if there's anything annoying about it, I think that annoyance comes from the fact that taxes are added to begin with that start this whole phenomenon. Now, the credit card late fees are a very different phenomenon here. This is not any kind of hidden cost. Everybody knows that if you don't make a payment, you're going to have to pay for it. You're going to have to pay some kind of fine. And it's important to remember that this is part of how credit card companies provide their service to us. This is part of how they make money. For those of us who just pay off our balance every month or whatever, we're getting a service for basically free. And it is a service. It's not like the credit card company is just letting me use my own money. No, they're letting me use money that I don't have that I'm going to pay back later. That is a service. That is value they are adding. And it's not just the borrowing of money. It's the making it possible for you to engage in effortless transactions all over the world, you know, instantaneously with all kinds of electronic interactions. That is a service that isn't free for anyone to provide for you. It has to be paid for. And they have to assemble all kinds of capital and complicated transaction systems to make this possible. They have to pay for it somehow, and they need to make a profit, and they should be able to make a profit. And those of us who, you know, are basically free riding off of this by paying off our balance, this is how it gets paid for, this and through other kinds of fees. And if somebody isn't paying those kinds of fees, the service isn't profitable, we don't get to actually use this service. And incidentally, it's not like the people who are late in their payments bear no responsibility. They knew they had a payment due. Why did they miss it? Why did they spend the money that they didn't have? That's something that is not the fault of the credit card company. It's the fault of the payment of the person who's using the credit card. And it's worth noting, Nikos, that there's been previous legislation that tried to cap fees on credit cards. Not necessarily the late fees, but other kinds of fees like transaction fees, the fees that merchants pay to the credit card company in order to be able to use their service. There was something, I think, in 2012 or 11 that did this. It was the Durbin Amendment. And when it was passed, what happened? Well, the cost of providing free checking accounts, they weren't free anymore. The cost of providing checking accounts went up. And so people who had free checking accounts lost them or had to start paying fees. And the people who this affected the most was the people who, obviously the people who needed free checking more than other people, so people with less money to spend. So if this happens, it's going to be a burden, not just on the people who are, you know, not getting to use all the points on their credit cards that they would like to, those of us who free ride off these systems, but other people too. And so this is a product that is not free to produce. It requires inputs. It has to be paid for somehow. Credit card companies are providing us a service, and they have the right to make a profit from it. And Biden is, again, casting all of this into the wind, assuming that these services come from nowhere and that the people producing them are, in effect, our servants or slaves.
So coming towards the end of this interview, Ben, let's try to get in the mind of Joe Biden and ask the more kind of zoom out questions, which is, why now? What is he trying to achieve with these interventionist measures? But before we get to that, another major question is, can Biden even, has he got the leeway, the freedom to implement these changes? So are these interventions that he's planning even allowable? Can he get away with it? What happens? Can the president tell, for example, Snickers, this is going to be the size of your chocolate bars?
Yeah, I mean, these two questions are related because part of the reason why he's talking about this now has to do with the fact that he doesn't have legal authority over very much. And so part of it is he's asking for the legal authority. That's part of why he's asking for the Congress to pass this bill that would somehow stop so-called shrinkflation. But a lot of the other stuff that he's proposing, he's doing through executive orders. And that's, of course, because there's a divided government, because he doesn't have the cooperation of Congress. One example of this, for instance, right now is that, so he's had a very active Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission trying to file various antitrust lawsuits. But Congress has not given him new funding to fund these lawsuits. The government has previously been, whenever there's a merger, for instance, companies are supposed to pay a fee to file to the FTC to get permission to merge. And sometimes those mergers are not even accepted or allowed, as just happened recently with the proposed airline merger between JetBlue and Spirit. And nonetheless, they had to pay a fee to not get that permission. And when those fees, typically the FTC had taken those fees and used it to fund their own lawsuits. So basically making these companies pay for their own persecutors. But Congress, there was a law that was changed. Congress said, you're not allowed to fund yourself that way. The money has to go back into general federal revenue. And so now the antitrust division doesn't have as much money. And so they can't do the lawsuits. So they have to find other ways of squeezing producers and through these kind of minuscule actions that will threaten lawsuits, even if not actually enact them. I mean, there's not a lot of ways in which price control can actually be done directly by force of law. There's only a small number of segments of the market where government has direct authority over prices. Most of the kinds of prices that Biden is talking about here are not those segments. And so, I mean, I think it's actually meaningful that he's calling it a strike force. This is not our language for it. We put this in the title. This is not our language for it. This is from the fact sheet that the Biden administration released saying we are assembling a strike force, a coalition of different agencies at the FTC and the DOJ and other alphabet soup agencies, where basically we are going to use threats of lawsuits and against various parties. Unpredictable, non-objective, completely arbitrary threats. And you know, if you look up strike force in a dictionary, it's a military force equipped and organized for sudden attack. And it's quite precise, I think, actually, for what Biden is talking about here. He wants to rule by fear. There's not actually a rule of law here. There's no law that's yet on the books that's going to permit him to do these things. But he leaves these companies guessing. Will I be next? We don't know. And then often they'll have to make these kinds of changes and themselves, anticipating that if they didn't make the changes that they needed to make a profit, they would be somehow batted down. And it's very popular for conservatives to criticize the Democratic administrations like the Biden administration for being socialist. And there's respects in which that's true. But what I think this kind of action shows is that where the modern Democratic Party tends is toward fascism and not socialism. And fascism means there's nominal property ownership, not nominal private property ownership, but the corporations who have it or the businesses who have that nominal ownership are ordered around by government, as you saw in historical fascist regimes. And so this is, I think, part of why it's not an accident that Biden is saying throughout the speech, I'm a capitalist. I'm not against corporations. Well, yeah, he's not against there being things called corporations that have nominal private property, but he still wants them to take his orders. And that's the hallmark, not of socialism, but of fascism.
Is there also an element, though, of that it's an election year and he wants to put, quote, more money in the pockets of ordinary people? Because to be honest, I agree with you. I don't think Biden is socialist. I don't think he's anything in particular. So is there also this element of that he's, quote, buying off votes from the people he expects them to vote for him in the 5th of November?
I mean, I think you're right that it's about the fact that this is an election year, but not because this is in any meaningful or realistic or long-term sense going to actually put money in the pockets of the voters. Mm-hmm. It's not really about helping the consumers. Deserving consumers are going to be harmed by all these policies for reasons I think that we talked about. They're going to get fewer life-saving drugs. It's going to be more difficult to access credit, checking accounts. It's going to be harder to find a home because there's going to be less incentive for producers to build them. So this is much less about actually helping out consumers or voters, more precisely, much more about blaming business, blaming the rich, blaming the successful. And this is generally, I think, of a piece with Biden's other approaches and policies that he mentions in this same State of the Union. He announces a very punitive approach to taxes, 25% basically wealth tax, not even based on income that he wants to, but on unrealized capital gains benefits, which is going to be so arbitrary to enforce. It's generally of a piece with his broader approach to antitrust, which is not only anti-producer, but anti-consumer even. I mean, there are all kinds of cases where he's filing antitrust suits against big business, not because they have any demonstrable effect on the consumer, because the consumers get the products for free. And here I'm talking about social media platforms, but simply because he thinks that the companies have too much, quote unquote, power. So what this really amounts to is a way of rallying his political tribe against a perceived enemy, where it is a perception, where it's a complete, it's based on red herrings and based on caricatures and based on myths. But it's invented, but it gets people angry. It gets them hating the other side. It gets them hating the producers and the businessmen, and therefore gets them to vote. But it doesn't actually do them any good. I think it really is just, it's nihilistic at the end of the day.
So you mentioned political tribes. So, okay, Biden is bad, but can we hope that the other side of the political spectrum, the supposed other side, the supposed defenders of free enterprise, the Republicans, are they up in arms against Biden's initiatives? Are they out there advocating why controls don't work and why we actually need more economic freedom?
Well, I don't get much hope from their reaction to this speech. With regard to the actual statist, collectivist economic policies that Biden proposed, what you're basically getting from Republicans is crickets. All the outrage is about the border. The border, and we did a previous episode on this, we're going to do it again. The border is one of these tribal political rallying issues. And it's no big surprise that this is the case, because as I indicated at the beginning, like, it's very significant that Speaker Johnson was nodding along with that anti-Wall Street statement from Biden at the beginning of the speech, because the modern Republicans don't really disagree with Biden or the Democrats on any of these fundamental moral political issues. The only exception that I've seen to this is there's been some commentary by people on the right about how it's, you know, the shrinkflation crusade is a distraction from the fact that Biden is responsible for inflation, which is partially true, but it's also true that Trump's policies during COVID contributed just as much, if not more, to our current inflation than what Biden has done. I mean, it was Trump who passed the PPP. It was Trump who signed legislation allowing all these checks to be written to Americans. That's what put the money into the economy and pushed up prices generally. And that's something that's going to have a long-term effect on an economy. It's not at all a surprise that something that he does at the end of his administration has effects in the current administration. Of course, Biden has not helped anything. He's also signed all kinds of basically welfare state legislation, infrastructure legislation, Recovery Act administration legislation, post-COVID, plowing even more money into the economy. That's not helping anything, obviously. But Republicans know that they share the blame for the current state of the economy just as much as Biden. And therefore, they don't want to draw attention to this fact. They want to be able to blame the same people that the Democrats are blaming. They want to be able to blame big business. And you see generally the same anti-business populist attitude arising on the right. You see it from Trump. You see it from his successors, people like Josh Hawley. They don't differ in principle at all from the Democrats. They concede the premises and the justifiability of all of Biden's worst policies. And so all they're left to fight with at the end is the border, is about the border controversy. That's why it's become a tribal rallying issue, is that it's the only thing they think that they want to, that they have the courage, or audacity is a better word for it, to want to pick a fight with Biden over. And note, by the way, that Biden doesn't actually have all that different of a policy stance from them. And this is evident from the legislation that he wanted to pass to do basically the same things at the border that the Republicans wanted to. And so it amounts to narcissism of small differences, which is exactly what you get when you have tribal political battles going on. So if you're looking for salvation from the Republicans versus Biden's statist collectivist economic policies versus his Marxist premises about economics and morality, don't look to the Republicans for an alternative.
Ben, you watched the long Biden speech, all that we didn't have to. Thank you for that. But let's see also some further possible sources that we can follow regarding getting a better understanding on the topic. So we have, you mentioned an interview you did with, and we'll see it also on the screen, our further resources. Here it is. So, an interview with Rob Tarr, understanding the roots of the new inflation. But also, you can see a previous episode with Ben and Onkar on the pure hatred of the new antitrust. This is on antitrust legislation, something that Biden also mentioned in his State of the Union address. Any other resources that our audience can follow? Egalitarians and Inflation is an essay by Ayn Rand from 1974, where, again, she talks about what is behind this, what is actually behind inflation and the statist responses to inflation. Now, in terms of future episodes and things that you want us to cover, you can send us your questions about specifically questions about objectivist philosophy. Every 2 weeks, there's a Q&A episode when someone from the team of the Ayn Rand Institute Intellectuals deals with the questions that you send. You can send the questions at experts@AynRand.org, experts@AynRand.org. But also, you can send us more general questions or suggestions for future episodes. And this, we have the newideal@AynRand.org email, newideal@AynRand.org email. Remember, your support is always appreciated. Your support could be liking this video, sharing it, starting a discussion in the comments. It's all very much appreciated. Ben, thank you very much. Many thanks to our viewers. See you next week.
You've been listening to New Ideal, a podcast from the Ayn Rand Institute. If you like what you hear, leave us a review, share with a friend, and subscribe to our other podcasts. This podcast was made possible by donors to the Ayn Rand Institute. Help support this podcast by becoming an ARI member. Go to AynRand.org/membership.